Centre at 5. The parents of terminally ill baby Charlie Gard have been told a new scan makes for sad reading. A barrister representing Great Ormond Street Hospital, where the 11-month-old is on life support, broke the news at a legal hearing. The High Court is deciding whether the baby can be taken abroad for treatment. Our reporter Ian Woods is there and says Charlie's parents were shocked by the update.
Connie Yates stormed out of court, essentially shouting, "What a way to find out such information." And then a few moments later, her husband Chris Gard looked directly at the Great Ormond Street barrister and said, "Evil."
It's the UK's busiest ever day of flights. The National Air Traffic Service says our airspace is rapidly reaching capacity. More than 750,000 planes are due to fly through the airspace between June and August, 40,000 more than the same time last year. Jamie Hutchison from the NATS Control Centre says it could mean more delays in future.
We experience 8 seconds of delay per flight per annum in the UK. It is very low, but that number will continue to creep up. By 2030, the assessments would suggest that we would have 50 times the level of delay today. In effect, 8,000 flights per annum potentially being cancelled.
A man's admitted murdering his brother and trying to kill his brother's girlfriend by setting fire to them as they slept. Blair Logan poured petrol on them at the family home in East Dunbartonshire on New Year's Day. Police have ended a search for a missing RAF gunner in a landfill site. They looked through 6,500 tonnes of waste for Corrie McCaig, who disappeared after a night out in Suffolk last September. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Emma Jones.
BCFM 93.2 plays more Bristol music than any other station. Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Green Party councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas, and former Bradley Stoke councillor, new UKIP leadership candidate, Ben Walker. After the 6 o'clock news, with even the survivors and families of the 9/11 victims appealing this week for Theresa May, please publish the report into Saudi funding of extremism in Britain. It's becoming the biggest open secret in the world that the US and British governments care more about their arms and oil deals with the Saudi Arabian dictatorship, royal family, than they do about keeping us from being blown up or attacked here in Britain. So this week we have a listen to former United Airlines pilot who was pointing out the massive Saudi connections to the 9/11 attacks 5 years ago in his book The Big Bamboozle, before he and his two children were found shot dead at his California home, just a few months after the book was published. We hear tonight what no other UK broadcasters seem fit to broadcast. That's an interview with murdered 9/11 whistleblower pilot Captain Philip Marshall tonight, from just before he was found dead in February 2013. Plus, trouble brewing again on Temple Mount in occupied East Jerusalem, with the Israeli army sealing off Al-Aqsa Mosque and doing security checks on everybody. In fact, stopping any male under 50 going in. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots after the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius with showers, highs of 18 Celsius. This weekend, some sunny spells, but heavy showers too. Next week, highs of 24 degrees, sunny spells, but also showers during the week next week. Next weekend, the 29th and 30th of July, highs at 22, and again, sunshine and showers. Looks like that's it for about the next 10 days. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Green Party councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas, and former Bradley Stoke councillor, who's now a candidate for the UKIP leadership. That's Ben Walker. Hi, welcome to the Politics Show.
Thanks very much.
Jerome, can we start with you? Tell us a bit about yourself. What got you into politics, and when did you become a councillor?
I became a councillor
2 years ago. And I've had a long-standing issue in, I suppose, social equality and environmental issues, which makes the Green Party a sort of natural home for me.
So what does that mean, social equality?
Just having a fairer society, I suppose. I think most people have a pretty good idea what that means.
We've got quite a lot about that tonight from Prime Minister's questions, various statistics coming out this week. But why Greens? Why not somebody else?
I was in the Labour Party for quite a long time, but I felt that the Labour Party wasn't really, didn't consistently take environmental issues seriously enough and the impact they have on everybody's quality of life.
Why not?
I think the need to appeal to marginal voters, and I think Labour can get a bit frightened that focusing too much on green issues and some of the potential sacrifices that might need to be made can put marginal voters off.
So now Jeremy Corbyn's the leader. Are you regretting your decision to leave the Labour Party?
No, I'm not. I think that there's been some really strong moves from Jeremy Corbyn in the right direction on environmental issues. But I think that sometimes it's difficult for the Labour leadership to choose between the interests of the trade unions and the some of the issues that really matter.
Well, in what way? In what way do those two come into conflict? Because quite often we think of the trade unions as really representing actually a lot more people than the political parties do in terms of membership.
Well, I think if you take the example of Trident, I think the fact that Labour is sitting on the fence so much about Trident is because their biggest financial supporters, their jobs benefit on Trident, and Jeremy Corbyn is unable to take seriously enough the issues of peace and our genuine security.
So you think the GMB and other big unions are bribing the party, really?
Yes.
Really? Okay. I mean, surely most parties, like even the Greens, are split on a lot of issues, just depending, because, I mean, a large people, they're not going to a number agree on anything, on everything, are they?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you can't get join a political party without having to deal with division.
We'll be hearing a bit more from Ben about that in a minute.
Yeah,
you
sure.
Know, what goes on in the Greens? Why is it you're seeing Labour as shambolic for having lots of different views, but you do too, don't you?
I didn't say that Labour was shambolic. I think it's confused. And I'm personally happier and happy working with my colleagues in the Green Party.
Ben, you were a councillor in Bradley Stoke. Just tell us briefly about your decision there to stop being a Conservative and go over to UKIP.
You ask me this every time.
No, but it's interesting. I think if you elect someone to one party,
yeah,
and then they change parties, people want to know, why have you done that? Hang on, we elected you to this party.
I was always a Conservative with a small C. I felt that was my natural home, being ex Royal Navy and all that sort of stuff. And then having worked for them, one of the biggest things that broke the back for me was that in 2010, we campaigned on the platform of saying that there'll be no top-down reforms of the NHS, and then the one that the Tories carried out, you could actually see from space. So I decided, you know, there's no way that I'm going on the doorstep to speak to people and sell this rubbish.
But isn't that what political parties do? They say one thing to get in, and then afterwards they just do whatever they want.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and I think that's one of the major problems with the voting system that we currently have, to be honest with you.
I mean, surely it's not just the voting system, is it? I mean, a political party can say absolutely anything.
I mean,
what are your thoughts about the successor or otherwise of Paul Nuttall as leader who took over from Nigel Farage?
You know, I like Paul as a guy. As a leader, meek, weak. It just wasn't his thing.
Well, what were the things that he was coming out with you thought didn't really cut the mustard?
The biggest thing for me, and the biggest thing that I've had a problem with recently from a UKIP perspective, was the integration agenda, which ended up becoming probably the main platform of which we stood for in the 2017 election.
What is the integration?
So it was the legislation, but obviously the idea of banning the burqa, because people that wore one needed more vitamin D. They wanted to check little girls in school, to try and see if FGM had been carried out. The whole thing was nuts. It's not, as a libertarian, which is what I consider myself to be, it's not something that I would ever support or could, and I didn't support, couldn't agree with it.
Something like FGM is a cultural thing, generally. It's surely got to be dealt with somehow.
Yeah, I mean, the truth of the matter is that we have laws in place to be able to deal with that. I think what we've got, though, is a very weak kind of PC culture that runs throughout all of our systems and organisations within the UK, and I don't think you can deal with anything like that until you actually deal with that problem.
But so, I mean, you know, it's all very well having a law in place, but unless you've got evidence that there
Absolutely
has been
right.
female genital mutilation going on to kids,
yeah.
I mean, surely you have to have some sort of inspection, otherwise you're never going to know.
Well, put it this way, if I was a Muslim, and if someone tried to check my little girl at school, that is only going to make me want to become an extremist. That's how much against what they were doing and the ideas that they were selling I am. You know, I do not believe in what they were trying to peddle.
Okay, so
it's
what
nuts.
Do you believe in? Now, you've got your Brexit, have you, or not?
Well, who knows? Yeah, I mean, we thought we had Brexit, but actually at the moment, it doesn't really look that way. I think we made some fatal errors, really, in our kind of strategic thinking with the general election. It just went. We thought that if we wouldn't stand in certain seats and we had a Brexit-friendly MP, that would help them. Actually, it didn't. I think what we did is we underpinned the Labour vote and we made Labour much stronger. UKIP is made up of a huge amount of old Labour voters, and you can't say to them, oh, you know what, we're not standing this time, go and vote Tory. My God, they're not going to do that. That's like asking a Bristol City fan to go and sit through 90 minutes at the Rovers ground. It's not going
to
happen.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, time to bring you in here, I guess, because don't you think that Ben's right? Actually, Labour did lose a lot of votes to UKIP unnecessarily?
Well, I think a lot of people who voted UKIP did vote Labour. And you can see that UKIP has got an appeal on both the left and the right of the spectrum. And I agree with what Ben said earlier, and I'm sure others in the room will agree with me, that the electoral system forces us to into the wrong decisions. If we had a proportional electoral system, my preferred method would be similar to the Irish system, where you have multiple MPs.
Hang on, aren't you confusing the referendum with the general election?
No, well, referendums are another issue. I mean, there is another question about whether referendums are binding. Under the British Constitution, they are not binding. Parliament is sovereign. If we had a written constitution, it would be different.
It sounds like the sort of thing we were hearing from Ben a minute ago about, well, they'll say one thing and then do something else after the election.
Yeah, well, you've
like
got to understand that, for example, in the six counties, both Protestants
and... Well,
we're
not in the six counties,
no, we're not,
we?
But up there, no. The referendum was clearly in favour of remaining inside the EU.
Well, lots of places it was the opposite.
No,
so,
but you've got to remember that Ireland is a foreign country.
Let me just explain.
It's not part of Britain.
Overall, the overall vote was Brexit. It wasn't... There was lots and lots of differences all across
indeed,
the country,
but you've got to
as there are in every single.
Yeah, but you've got to recognise
election.
That Ireland is a very special case, because Ireland isn't actually part of the United Kingdom, although it is part of the United Kingdom, but only by agreement with Dublin and with the minority in the six counties. The original nine counties of Ulster have a Catholic majority. The six counties were carved out of the Irish Republic in the 1920s to provide a Protestant majority. But what's very interesting about what happened in the referendum is that middle-class, moderate Protestant opinion voted to remain inside the EU,
what is
even though they don't want to leave
the UK. What
is
even more interesting is it wasn't enough to swing the vote. So
it wasn't enough, but also, yeah. As I said earlier, Tony, referendums are advisory under the British Constitution. They've had loads of referendums in Northern Ireland, and they don't mean anything, because following it, DUP are now the biggest party in Northern Ireland.
Well,
does that mean that they have to obey the referendum result or follow their own devices?
We know,
own devices?
You're a, what one might call, Remainer, yeah? And you don't
I
agree with
that
you don't agree
I accept
with
that
the
leaving.
Vote. Yeah, but anyway, this week I think actually you'll find a lot of common ground with Goldman Sachs, because today top Goldman Sachs banker has been pushing the government to commit to an urgent transition deal. Goldman Sachs employs around 6,500 people. I mean, I think they're putting it forward here in the Independent newspaper as this is very important. These 6,500 people, we must keep their jobs in London. And the bank's boss Lloyd Blankfein has already issued scathing warnings about the effect of Brexit. Now, this I suppose is one of the key things, and you as a candidate to lead UKIP, Ben, you've got to answer this. As people like Goldman Sachs are saying, it's going to be an economic disaster.
Make no mistake about it, all right? The whole... If we were to leave tomorrow, which, in my personal opinion, that's what we should have done ages ago anyway. We voted to leave, we should have pulled out. But if we left tomorrow, it's not going to be, this utopian kind of idea that people will sell you. It's going to be difficult. But Brexit hasn't happened yet, and we're still... which we're chatting about, and we're trying to talk ourselves out of it. But once we've done it, it will be difficult. But I promise you that at the end of that process... we will prosper as a nation. I'm sure of that.
But it's not going to be just when we leave, is it? Because a lot of businesses are looking at, well, they're going to be repositioning themselves so that possibly they're not based in Britain anymore after we've left.
Well, it's very true. And, you know, if you were to ask me a bit about sort of business in the UK, I mean, my idea with that is that I don't like the fact that business is pulling so many strings when it comes to what the government does anyway. And that, I think, is another debate for another day.
It might be actually some common ground there with Jerome. Jerome, what's your thoughts on Brexit and whether in 2 years' time it will actually happen?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that we know at the moment what Brexit means, because what was offered during the referendum isn't what's on the table now. So, I mean, it's a big issue whether we're going to get a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit. And you've got in Parliament a sort of push from the leadership of both of the main parties towards a hard Brexit if that's what's needed. But you've then got the massive majority of MPs who are actually quite centrist and would prefer either not to see Brexit at all or to see a soft Brexit. And then you've got business, which is profoundly concerned about the impact on businesses and employment that would come from a hard Brexit. And there's a whole range of issues that, you know, from the financial services to Euratom to how we deal with aviation, that it's ludicrous to suggest that we can just leave Europe and everything will be okay.
I mean, like with aviation, something I know a little bit about. I mean, you've got the European Aviation Agency, but we've still got our Civil Aviation CAA, Civil Aviation Authority, here in Britain still. So there's a lot kind of parallels, and I guess it means that the powers would come back to CAA, which are now from other, you know, in the European mould.
Yeah, but, I agree. But, I mean, it takes time to work that out, and in the meantime, you've got EasyJet moving operations to Vienna, so it knows that it can continue to fly around Europe once Brexit takes place.
Haven't they done that for tax reasons?
That's not my understanding.
No? Why? Well, because
in order to be able to fly around Europe once an uncertain Brexit takes place.
I mean, I seem to remember British Airlines flying around Europe before the common market even.
Yeah, but you've got a whole complex web of laws and regulations, and airlines will need to know under what jurisdiction they're flying come 2019.
Martin, I guess the big question here is, I'm going to put this to you too as well, where do you think we're going to be in 2 years' time?
Well, I think inevitably there's going to be lots of discussions. I accept that Brexit is going to take place. I think there's a consensus view around that now. The question then becomes, what does it mean? And, you know, people are talking about the European Free Trade Area. We mentioned that a few times
on this programme, but it doesn't seem to have been talked about hardly at all in the mainstream press as well. This is the EFTA, which has got the European Free Trade Area Court, which looks after all sorts of trade disputes within that. That's this organisation, which is not part of the EU, not part of the European Court of Justice, not part of any of those main or the European Parliament, but it is where we all find Switzerland, you'll find Iceland, you'll find Norway in there.
Well, interestingly enough, Norway has flagged up this week that they're not necessarily prepared to accept Britain inside EFTA, because that would actually unbalance it. You've got several small countries in which Norway pulls a big weight.
I suppose they see
Britain,
the city
with 60 some odd million people join, that will change the balance of power inside EFTA. So that may not be on the table, even if people wanted it to be on the table. Talking about a hard Brexit and going back to WTO rules, which is basically what the right of the Tory party are talking about, the DUP will never accept that, because it means a hard border in Northern Ireland. And they share with Sinn Féin a determination that there isn't going to be a hard border. That means that Theresa May is not going to be able to negotiate a hard Brexit, which means that the right wing of her party are going to topple her, which means we'll have a general election, which means that probably a Labour-led coalition will negotiate a soft Brexit. That's what will happen in 2 years' time.
Looking at the economic figures at the moment, it does not looking good. I don't know whether Martin, do we blame this on Brexit or not? Or would this have happened anyway?
I think it would have happened anyway. The idea that Brexit is going to cause a major crash in Britain but not a crash anywhere else is wrong.
The Guardian's reporting today the UK deficit jumped in June. The Britain borrowed £6.9 billion in June, which was £2 billion more than the year earlier. So this is way above estimates. £2 billion.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a bad thing. thing.
This is two times the bribe that was paid to the DWP.
I know, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. One of the things that's happened in the general elections, we're no longer obsessing about the size of the deficit. It's not that you're going to ignore deficits, but everybody clearly realises it doesn't matter as much as people think.
Does it matter?
It doesn't. In actual fact, if you've got a weak economy, inevitably the government has a bigger deficit, because that's like having an airbag in your car. Yeah, it stops your head going through the windscreen.
So would you agree with maxing out your credit card?
No, maxing out the credit card is a silly way to talk about it. National economies do not function like credit cards with a massive interest rate on them. What happens when you have weak capitalist economies is, because of the welfare state system that's been built up in most modern states, the government spends more and and taxes less, and that actually protects the economy from collapse.
If you look at our 1.7 trillion debt now, that does look like the credit card is being maxed out a bit.
Yes, but the credit card maxed out. It's not a credit card. Credit cards never existed in the 1950s. They only came in the 1960s and 70s.
Well, credit
politicians
existed,
talking
didn't
about using the credit
but
card.
Martin,
the
credit
the interest rate, Tony, the international interest rate is near zero. Near zero. So at that point, you can borrow any amount of money you like.
Well, until it starts going.
Yes, but you don't necessarily have to pay back. At some point, you can default. That's what Greece should do. They should leave the euro and default, which would crash Deutsche Bank, which is the biggest bank in Germany, which would crash the EU, which would crash Britain. What's really going to happen is there's going to be a crash.
Thing? Is that a good thing?
No, it's not a good thing. But what we've done is we've spent years and years and years talking about Brexit when we should have been talking about Deutsche Bank, because it's nothing to do with Brexit.
To be fair, we have been talking about the banks quite a bit, particularly
on
this programme.
I do bang on about
it every
week.
We started this show in 2009. We have been talking about that. But look, let's get back to our guests, because the effect of this, I think, is what people care almost more about. And we've seen this week, Jerome, the largest crime rise in England and Wales for 10 years. Also, looking at those figures, the Financial Times is saying that the UK crime, this is rising now at its fastest pace for 18 years.
I mean, it's difficult to get to the underlying truth behind the figures, because actually you want to encourage people to report crime, and there's quite a strong feeling that actually what was happening before was that it was being underreported. So more reporting of crime, particularly violent crime, is a good thing, and you may get a spike in the figures from that.
I mean, there's other side to that, surely, which is that we've got less police officers, haven't we? So
you've got fewer police officers, yes, and you know, it's undoubtedly the case that you would have thought, going through the kind of recession, low economic growth, austerity that we've had, that you would see some sort of rise in crime. And then I think there's sort of some controversial issues around stop and search and the decline in that, and as you say, Tony, reduction in police officers, which will have some impact on that. And you know, actually it's really important that we do all we can, and we support the police and other agencies to get crime, and particularly violent crime, down. And I think one of, you know, my particular concerns is the complete decimation of funding for youth services, because if kids in society aren't feeling valued, then they will act in an alienated way, and that can lead to violent behaviour.
Ben, the Office for National Statistics figures come out on the same day as these crime figures. They're saying that nearly 5 million crimes were recorded by the police in the last year. Now, that's about 500,000 more than the previous years, hence this figure of around about 20% increase.
The hard and fast truth about the figures with the police is that successive governments now have cut the life out of the police. And not only have they done that, the police have no confidence in any government minister, be it whatever, be it Labour or be it Tory, that come to them and speak to them. You know, you've got some real issues there. I know I'm not saying that we need thousands and thousands and thousands more police. That's not the idea. But we do need more police, and we need a police force that actually believes that they're acting within the interests of what the government want, and they'll be supported. And I don't think that they feel that way at the moment.
Martin?
I think it's easy to... I mean, statistics like this, there's usually complex factors involved. As has been suggested, there may be more reporting, for example, of domestic violence.
Well, they always
violence.
Say this. I mean, listen, no, when I'm, I was, I'm, listen, for the early 1990s, I can tell you, they always say, oh, well, you know, it could be just that the figures...
Well,
the way
be.
The figures are reported
are different.
But the
point is, that's a logical every point, Tony, it could be.
Every year they say the same thing. So let's just assume there's some truth to this.
All right, well, let's just put it this way. In actual fact, there's very clear statistical evidence that when people are poorer as a result of... recession, austerity, whatever, they tend to commit more crimes. There's a pretty clear statistical correlation. So you, people who, if you were a young person and you were being sanctioned by the benefits office, and you've got the option of engaging in, for example, some drug dealing on your street, non-violent crime, unless you get involved with nasty people, would you schlep into the benefits office to be slagged off every week, or would you just slip out of the system and do something else instead? I know loads of people are in exactly that position, and you know what? They don't always go down the benefits office.
Now, it's funny you should say that, Martin, because on my little list of stories this week, I've got one in the Mirror from yesterday, I think it was, saying, I dropped out of society to save my sanity. And there is this Wigan Pierce, it's a part of the Daily Mirror's homelessness, I always call it a campaign, it's almost like the Paul Foot days, where they're really looking very, very carefully at the way that certain people are now living in this country, say, for example, in tunnels under cities and this kind of thing, as part of our Road to Wigan Pier 2017 project, say the Mirror, 80 years on from the publication of George Orwell's essay, rough sleeper Raymond Slater explains how sleeping rough saved his sanity. He's been homeless for the last 15 years and is currently living in Manchester. After struggling to manage on benefits, he dropped out of the system to save his dignity. As he tells Claire Donnelly, he has never been happier. He says, I spent years trying to find work, going to interviews, signing on, and it was constant stress.
It is. I mean, don't forget, the Tory governments that we've had have made it deliberately unpleasant to claim benefits in order to deter people. And then, of course, the sanctions kick in if you don't jump through the hoops. And then eventually people are cut off. At that point, they either beg or they steal. And people with spirit steal. They don't beg.
Ben, what do you make of that?
To be honest, I do kind of agree with Martin. I think that's very true. You know, I believe in a welfare state that is there as a safety net. Of course I do. But the problem is, with the benefits system and the changes that it's experienced, there has been very much that they're trying to attach some sort of stigma to people that, you know, that claim, for whatever reason it might be, whether it be incapacity or whether it be, you know, they haven't got a job. But we need to look at our welfare state. It's not fit for purpose, and it needs to change. And
one of the big problems has been, I think, sorry to interrupt you, but it's been this whole sanctions thing. So you can sometimes, and I got hit with this when I was signing on myself, is I got told that I had been invited to an interview that I didn't attend. I hadn't actually been invited, and yet still I got told that you're going to have to live on nothing for 3 weeks.
This is the problem. I mean, I completely agree that we have a safety net for our society. The trouble is, government are fixated on concentrating on things like this when we should really be looking at other state departments where we can actually save real money. I mean, for me, one of those would be foreign aid. You know, we are actually in a situation where we give masses amounts of money to foreign countries, and actually you could argue that we're keeping that country in poverty.
Well, actually, a lot of this money is what they call, I think, white propaganda or grey propaganda, isn't it? It's going to buy influence in that country.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're currently funding space programmes, or countries with a space programme. We're funding bans. You know, we're now giving in a position where we're giving money to Argentina, for Pete's sake. What's that all about? You know, why are we doing this? Actually, and then we're attacking our own people.
Jerome, what do you make of this? You know, are we spending too much on foreign aid?
I think it's kind of UKIP looking for new things to complain about now that Brexit is out of the way.
I mean, is it okay spending this money on foreign aid?
Well, I mean, we're one of the wealthiest countries in the world.
No, we're not. That's not true.
Well,
we're actually not. Look at the figures. Yeah, it looks that way, but we're not.
The figures are, I believe at the moment, I think we're the seventh richest in the world, Ben.
Yeah, so we're the seventh richest country in the world. You're talking about 0.7% of GDP going in development aid to the poorest countries in the world, with hundreds of years of us benefiting from their resources and often significant exploitation.
But here's a concept.
If I just finish, Ben?
Yeah, sorry.
So, I mean, what we're seeing at the moment in terms of the refugee crisis is going to be nothing compared to what we're going to be experiencing over the next 50 years with climate change and migration from climate change. And how we spend our money and our development aid is a really important issue. I mean, I agree with Ben, it needs to be well spent. But it's actually, there's a level of self-interest in supporting countries to be more resilient, to deal with the long-term impact of climate change. and in the long term to create fairer societies.
I think what Ben is saying, in a way there, I might paraphrase you, Ben, is that, look, we're spending this money on helping, say, I don't know, a space programme somewhere. I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but anyway, and people want it to be spent here in Bristol keeping our libraries open.
Yeah.
Well, there's other places that I would look for savings first. I mean, I think having new aircraft carriers, Trident, planes that don't work at 35 million quid a pop, there's no shortage of places that we should be looking for savings to be made.
This is your department, Ben, isn't it? As ex Royal Navy, would you let us know what you think about this, the Windows XP aircraft carrier?
Wow. If you currently... okay, well, if you look at military spending as a whole, so we have this target of, we tried to hit 2% of GDP of the country. You know, we're currently just hobbling over that at the moment. The truth of the matter is, we actually need to be spending in the region of 3% to meet our current commitments. Now, we are putting our servicemen and women in positions, asking them to do jobs that they are grossly underfunded and ill-equipped to do. So that, for me, is wrong to start. I would actually spend more on our military capabilities. Now, that's not just about us being able to fire missiles at people or whatever. It's about employment in areas that depend on the military. So when you talk about Trident, for example, you know, if we were to pull the plug on Trident, which... as it stands, I wouldn't agree with, but you then pull a huge amount of money out of local economies and you would crash areas. And then we'd think we'd have a problem with welfare. My God, we would then.
What about Yemen? Because there's British forces, not I don't think Royal Navy, but British forces over in Yemen, certainly in Saudi Arabia. They reckon there's a team of about 100 over there who are aiding the Saudi Arabians in doing things like targeting, and they don't seem to be doing a very good job of that, because we've now got what Al Jazeera and Oxfam have been reporting today to be the worst outbreak of cholera ever in history as now happening in Yemen, and there are British troops there aiding to exacerbate the problem by helping enforce a blockade of Yemen.
Yeah, the whole Saudi relationship that our government has, I have a real problem with. Now, I don't mind, you know, I'm a free marketeer. I want to do business with everyone that we possibly can. However, you know, personally, I have a strong moral code, and I think as a country we should do too. So if a certain country, i.e. Saudi, is, you know, not really adhering to the code or the morals that we would, I just don't think we should be dealing with these people.
Martin, more than 360,000 suspected cholera cases have now been recorded in just over 3 months in war-ravaged Yemen, says Oxfam. Oxfam believes it's the worst on record.
Well, I mean, our role in this has been pretty reprehensible, let's face it. The relationship with the Saudis worked with British intelligence and special forces to wreck Syria. British special forces were employed in Syria, and they're possibly operating inside Yemen. We've certainly got people working in Saudi Arabia, and... the Saudis, as we're probably going to hear in part two.
But we're certainly going to be hearing quite a lot about this in part two.
I mean, the fact is, a lot of the aid we give is actually tied to our military spending. So, for example, we give look at the US support of the State of Israel. Every citizen of the State of Israel gets a massive $1,000 subsidy from the United States taxpayer every year. And that's not because they're poor, it's because they're the allies of the United States. Egypt was let off 50% of its international debts in 1991 in order to participate in the first Gulf War. This is the way the real world works. Most of the aid we give is actually tied to British... I mean, what happened in Tanzania is we gave aid to the Tanzanians to buy a military radar system, which they didn't need, because we wanted to BAE Systems, and their shareholders wanted to sell it. And of course, investigations into the Spheris Fraud Office into Saudi Arabia were squashed by Tony Blair.
Is this the Al Yamamar deal?
The Al Yamamar deal was the biggest deal in history, and Mark Thatcher made £12 million out of that. That's the British taxpayer money into Mark Thatcher's pocket via that deal. Now, that's how wicked it all really is. And the war in Yemen, the war in Libya, the war in Syria. I mean, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, went on French TV 3 years ago, and he said, before the war started in Syria, I was approached by British officials, MI6. They said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? Well, so the jihadi rebels inside Syria have been trained by our own special forces at our expense.
I'm going to put this one on you, I'm afraid, because what we're hearing, I mean, Martin that certainly Martin and I have heard is that, and from the former Syrian ambassador John Ford just a few weeks ago, was that there are British troops in Syria now still who are involved in training some of our friendly rebels. Now, you're talking about supporting our armed forces. Would you support that?
Well, when I talk about supporting our armed forces, I'm talking about supporting people like me. I mean, I served. I've always considered myself to be a public servant, and I'll act in the interest of the government. That doesn't necessarily mean I want to go somewhere that they're sending me. So I was involved in the Afghan war. I served there. I didn't want to go. I never agreed with it, but I had to go. So I'm supporting basically our very own, you know, our own men and women. Like Martin, I cannot substantiate or support in any way, shape or form any of the recent conflicts. I mean, most of our interventions have been disgusting and for the wrong reasons. So I could never come out in support of anything that the government's done in recent times, to be fair with you.
Jerome, what do you make of, you know, looking at this international angle, particularly with Yemen?
Well, first of all, I was just picking up on Ben's point about us being a poor country and not having enough money to spend on aid. But then Ben was saying that we need, you know, that it's fine to spend the money on Trident and on aircraft carriers and on jets that don't work.
And on HS2.
Oh, I don't agree with the jets
and
that don't work.
And on HS2, we've seen this week as well, haven't we?
In terms of Yemen, I think there's a huge issue, and I think Martin's put his, you know, finger on some of the sort of really deep corruption that takes, you know, that underpins the arms trade with Saudi. I think that Saudi's oppression with regards to which is a country where it's trying to close down Al Jazeera.
Well, the Saudis are threatening the Qataris, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, Saudis and Emirates, in fact,
and Donald Trump.
Yeah, all of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries threatening Qatar to try and get Al Jazeera.
So, what's happening with Qatar at the moment, and Al Jazeera and sort of suppression of freedom of speech and media, as we know, Saudi is the US and UK go-to ally in the Middle East, and it's unacceptable.
And Israel, of course. Martin brought Israel up. I'm going to bring that up as well, because next week we're going to be doing a special on the Israeli conflict, because it's the same time every year in July when there's always this attempt by the Third Temple Institute, which is a Zionist fundamentalist group that want to rebuild the Third Temple and knock down the Muslim Dome of the Rock, because just over the last week or so we've seen all sorts of stuff going on there. The world has been reacting, says Al Jazeera, by the way, which is still going strong, to an Israel-Palestinian fallout over the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The United States, Jordan, Turkey and Lebanon have all weighed in as protests continue over the Israeli-led restrictions on Palestinians at the holy site. So, Martin, first of all, we saw last weekend a cordon put around by Israeli security forces. Remember, this is in East Jerusalem, which is occupied East Jerusalem, everyone being told if they wanted to go into the mosque, they've got to have a metal detector security check, which people said, no, we're not going to do that. So they've been worshipping outside in the street. And now today, the Israelis have announced that no male under 50 years old is going to be allowed into the mosque at all.
Well, the fact is they shouldn't really be in control. I mean, the state of Israel was recognised in 1948 on the basis of borders that were agreed. They've never worked within those borders, and therefore it's perfectly legitimate for the rest of the world to say, well, in that case, we're not necessarily going to recognise you as a state. Kosovo isn't recognised as a state. Kashmir isn't recognised as a state. Wales isn't an independent state. Why should Israel be an independent state if it's not going to play by the rules? And I think they're in alliance with the Saudis, and we're in alliance with the pair of them in order to try and dominate the Middle East, and that's how it's perceived in the Middle East, which is why we fight these wars and we kill loads of people, but we don't win anything. We always lose.
Ben, Al Jazeera, I'm plugging them again. Al Jazeera today on this same article are saying that Israel has cancelled Friday prayers today, shut down the entire compound for the first time since 1969, prompting outrage amongst Palestinians. This is just a week before the attempt by the Zionist fundamentalist group, the Third Temple Institute, to rebuild the Jewish temple on the same site as the Dome of the Rock. What do you make of this conflict? It seems like we've got a bit of a brewing religious conflict going on here. We hear a lot about Islamic fundamentalism, but not so much about the Zionists.
No, that's true. And I think, you know, in equal measure, they're both issues. I mean, when it comes to the whole kind of conflict there, I mean, I do agree in there, in being Israel. You know, I agree with that. But what I don't like about what they do is the way that they enforce that. And Martin has obviously touched on that. But I don't know. I mean,
use the word apartheid to describe it? Some people do.
Yeah, I wouldn't use that word, but I can understand why people would. I can see why they draw those kind of conclusions about it. But there's got to be some way forward that we can get the State of Israel to operate within kind of the agreement. I guess back in 1948, one of the worst things they did was they just drew straight lines. You know, that was, you know, the EU have kind of done that to a certain degree, but, you know, and we still haven't learned. But that was probably one of the worst mistakes then. It was just a straight line carve-up of the Middle East, and that should never have happened.
Now, Jerome, for the Green Party, I know we're getting away from Bristol here a bit, but what do you make of this conflict over in the Middle East? It does seem to have not gone away in my lifetime, actually. I don't know why, but it's still there.
No, I mean, it's an intractable problem, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere at the moment. I mean, progress seems to be backwards, if anything. And I think at the heart of it is how you can either get a two-state solution to work or a one-state solution. And at the heart of it are issues of apartheid and democracy.
Do you come down on one side or the other?
I don't understand the situation well enough.
Okay, Martin, give you the last word on Palestine. What's going to happen next week? And are we going to have a nice peaceful time? Is there going to be access for Muslims to the mosque? And what's the significance if the Israelis, as it looks like they've done today, just close it off?
Well, the danger is that we're going to get a general war in the Middle East. The Syrian conflict, the Qatar situation, Yemen, all of these brush fires are going to turn into one big fire. And if it does happen, I'm afraid Brexit will be pretty, is going to be small beer. Because, of course, something like that will crash the banking system. And long before we talk about Brexit, we're going to be talking about what we're going to do about this or that or the other. Okay. The real issue, of course, is can the Russian air defence defend Syria against a NATO air attack?
Okay, can it? That's, or not?
The stuff I read, and I'm not an expert, is that the jury's out. It certainly won't be a pushover like bombing Libya or Iraq. Let's put it that way. The Russian air defences will be formidable.
Ben, if you were a pilot, not necessarily in one of these F-35s that doesn't fly very well, would you be a little bit nervous flying over Syria
with
the Russians?
Oh, without doubt. I mean, the capability of the Russians has been underestimated for a long time. You know, some of the equipment that they've got, it outshines ours incredibly. You know, it will put us to shame. And I'm not even so sure that the Americans have got the equipment that they have these days.
Okay, let's get back down to Bristol and, to the UK anyway. And I just thought we'd have a listen to Prime Minister's questions. This is Jeremy Corbyn, Leader of the Opposition, and Theresa May here. Jeremy Corbyn bringing up the point that we've now got something like 8 million people in Britain living in poverty, even though many of them are working.
Jeremy Corbyn! Can I invite the Prime Minister to take a check with reality on this? Mr. Speaker, 1 in 8 workers in the United Kingdom, that is 3.8 million people in work, are now living in poverty. 55% of people in poverty are in working households. The Prime Minister's lack of touch with reality goes like this. Low pay in Britain is holding people back at a time of rising housing costs, rising food prices and rising transport costs. It threatens people's living standards, and rising consumer debt and falling savings threatens our economic stability. Why doesn't the Prime Minister understand that low pay is a threat to an already weakening economy?
What the best route out of poverty is through work, and what we now see is hundreds.
Order. The question has been asked. The Prime Minister's answer must, and however long it takes, it will be heard. The Prime Minister.
The best route out of poverty is through work. That's why it's so important that over the last 7 years we have seen 3 million more jobs being created in our economy. It's It's why we now see so many thousands of people in households with work rather than in workless households. Many more, hundreds of thousands more children being brought up in a household where there is work rather than a failure to have work. That's what's important. But what's important for government as well is to ensure that we do provide support to people. That's why we created the National Living Wage. That was the biggest pay increase for people on lowest incomes ever. When did the Labour Party ever introduce the National Living Wage? Never. That was a Conservative government on a Conservative record.
Well, I think insofar as she says that we've introduced the national minimum wage, she's to be commended. But the fact of the matter is that we've got a very low wage, low productivity economy. We're specialising in cheap and cheerful. We've also got zero interest rates and a property bubble caused by QE. We've had 8 years of printing money. And, of course, what happened after the Brexit referendum is the Bank of England went out and printed a load more money, which is why you didn't have an immediate Brexit effect. But, of course, now we're getting it. And it's not just Brexit that's causing problems. The whole Western world is have got problems because of the economic model that's been adopted. Brexit just adds
to the potential crisis. She's also talking there about 3 million more jobs in Britain. Surely, it's actually looking reasonably good. I mean, and also this whole thing of work is a Work is a root out of poverty.
I think the problem is that a lot of these jobs are not very well paid, and the bigger issue, as you touched upon earlier, is housing costs. So there's a huge unfairness in wealth between the younger generation, people like myself in our 50s and above, who are homeowners and benefited from rising house prices through our adult lives, and how we deal with the huge inequality in wealth is probably one of the biggest political challenges of our time. And I think it's one of the reasons why Jeremy Corbyn is speaking to such a large audience.
Before we hear from Ben Walker on this, let's have a listen to Dan Carden, who picks up on the effect of this mass poverty on children in his constituency.
Dan Carden.
Here.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In Liverpool, Walton, my constituency, almost 40% of children are growing up in poverty.
Shame.
With schools closing this week and local support services cut to the bone, austerity bites and kids don't get fed. The Prime Minister's mission, as she says it, is to make Britain a country that works for everyone. What is she doing now to stop kids going hungry this summer in Liverpool, Walton?
Yeah.
Can I first of all welcome the Honourable Gentleman again to his place in this House. And he's right that it is important that we look at the provision that is made in school for children. We look at this issue of households and poverty. But as I said to his right honourable friend, the Leader of the Opposition, the best way that we can deal with poverty, the best route out of poverty, is for people to get into the workplace and then for us to ensure that there are other jobs, better paid jobs being provided for people in the workplace in the future.
Ben, poverty, well, we've just heard quite a lot of figures there. That was Dan Carden talking about 40% of children in his constituency are now officially living in poverty. And Jeremy Corbyn telling Theresa May we've got 8 million families across the country in the same state.
Yep, I can't say I recognise the stats, but I can recognise what they're saying, and I agree with kind of both sides. I agree with what Jeremy Corbyn is trying to say and the points he's making, but I can also see the point of view of the Prime Minister, whereby, work does pay, but we do have a strange imbalance in this country, which we need to get right, and we can't just keep going on and sort of trying to offer handouts to people who are finding it hard. We have to encourage them into work, but I'm afraid that I don't think that system works well enough anyway.
I think most people would say that some of the jobs that they're going into, they actually end up worse off. I think, Martin, actually, maybe you were in a job where you took a job and you ended up worse off, didn't you?
Yeah.
Well, I think the problem is it's rents. And, of course, because we've not solved the housing problem, you've got the buy-to-let landlord classes, if you like, have been making money, not just people who've got their own houses, but people who've got, more than one. And the rent is what kills people, particularly in a city like Bristol. So even if you go out to work, most of your money's got to go on rent. And, you know, if you add council tax in as well, which probably is going to be brought in soon in Bristol, although, you know, people on benefits didn't have to have it. But, of course, many people in work are still claiming benefits because they haven't got enough to pay the rent. And that's because we haven't solved the housing problem. And, of course, the Grenfell Tower disaster has brought home in a very graphic way what's wrong with Britain's housing policy for 30 years. And we had 13 years of Labour government, and they didn't do anything about it. We're pretty angry about that, and that's one of the reasons why Corbyn has made such
pay. We did a bit of a study on this a few years ago on this programme of the finance, of how much it costs to build a house and how much it costs to buy or rent a house and how long they last, which is something like, you know, 200 years. Obviously, you need to do some maintenance along those 200 years. But the actual cost, if you were to spread it across that long period of time, you're talking about something like £3 or £4 a week, and yet people are paying hundreds and hundreds of pounds a week for their housing. But now, I'd just like to mention the Grenfell Tower thing briefly, because I know, Jerome, you were involved in risk management. I imagine this was a horrific thing in the risk management world. Tell us, first of all, what you do in risk management, and then what you made of the Grenfell Tower.
My business focuses on fire safety management and health and safety management, and we've got responsibility for risk assessment for retailers, housing associations, some local authority work, and hospitals. So it's sort of very central to the sort of thing that we're doing.
So what did you make of this? I mean, we're told no fire alarms.
Yeah, I think that at the heart of Grenfell is the sort of stay put policy, and the way that the fire procedures were designed was that people were considered by the fire authorities to be safe in the building in the event of a fire, and 99 times out of 100 that would be the case. What they didn't anticipate was the way that the external cladding of the building was going to go up in flames. And I think that the problem that we've got there is a lack of appropriate building regulations, particularly when we could have learnt from there was a fire in Southwark in a place called Lackenhall House a few years back. And we should have learnt the lessons from that in terms of appropriate building regulations. What we saw in Scotland was that when there was a fire on cladding, sort of 1999, Scotland made the changes to the building regulations, which meant that you can't have the kind of materials that you had on the exterior of Grenfell Tower. So the Scots have got it right.
So why is there such a thing as flammable cladding?
Well, if I just finish what I said about the building regulations, what we had with David Cameron and the Conservatives, and I think you had the Daily Mail leading on it, was the complaint about health and safety gone mad. And actually, David Cameron said in 2012 that he wanted to end the safety culture. Now, this sort of tragedy, I'm afraid, is the inevitable consequence of that sort of pronouncement around safety management.
Yeah. Ben, what do you make of this? Are you surprised people haven't been arrested?
Yes, basically. But I would hope that following a thorough investigation, there will be some sort of, some sort of recompense for the people that have been involved in this. And being in construction myself now, I wouldn't say that it's some sort of wholesale deregulation of building regulations, because it isn't, because all of those still exist. But what happened was that the government of the time decided that they wanted to make things a lot easier and speedier. So they have allowed private companies to come in. So now private companies can act and they can inspect building work. But obviously local authorities still do that. But the problem's bigger than that.
It's actually also, sorry to interrupt, but we also have fire inspections now, not done by the fire brigade. The Grenfell Fire Risk Assessor, this is a story we had a couple of weeks ago, shocking, was paid £250,000 for his work. He then urged the council to bury his fire risk report. This is a chappie called Carl Stokes, was paid £244,318 over 7 years as the fire risk assessor for Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation. That is the people who were managing that block.
Can I just say, one of the problems here is what I was trying to say as well, I guess, is that, I mean, I've worked on sites and with all the sort of big complexes, and when you get the building inspector out, be it local authority or be it a private one, they don't inspect every unit. they don't inspect every house. They might look at one, and then obviously the builder or the construction company are going to show them that one. And that's one of the massive problems here.
But you isn't know, the problem as well that if they find anything wrong, they might not get the contract next time?
This is true. There's so many issues going wrong here, and I don't think that this focus on the building regulations isn't the right one. I think it should be a focus on how we're actually carrying out the inspections to make sure that we're meeting the current building regulations, because I don't think that's really happening very well.
Sorry, can I just interrupt there? Because I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Ben. I think that what's happening with building control after buildings have gone up is that you're getting private building control people rather than the local authorities, and the local authorities have had their funding for doing the building control work really cut. Mm. So you get exactly that kind of thing of selective viewing of what's happened, and it's not a sufficient safeguard to make sure that these buildings do what they're supposed to be doing.
That's absolutely another fact as well. Probably be our last story. Staggering rise in prison violence means youth jails are no longer safe, says Prison Watchdog. Violent incidents in jails are up 27%. Martin, what you might probably say that's because the reporting of these has been done differently this year. But anyway, amid a dramatic decline in standards, says HM Inspectorate of Prisons this week, not one youth jail in England and Wales is now deemed safe after a staggering rise in violence over the past year, Prison Watchdogs warned.
Well, prison officers have been saying stuff about this for years and ignored.
Ben?
Oh, don't get me started on Law and Order. It costs too much money to keep prisoners. Prison isn't a deterrent anyway. You have prison officers in there who are basically working in the private sector, who aren't paid enough money to support their own families. You know, prison itself is just a place that's breaking down, and it needs a massive overhaul.
Jerome, the easy access to drugs and soaring numbers of inmates locked up for well over the recommended period also contributed to a vicious cycle, which emphasis on rehabilitation has declined, says Peter Clark, HM Chief Inspector of Prisons. So effectively our prisons are becoming universities of crime. Mm.
Yes, I think the other fact that hasn't been mentioned is the reduction in spending on prison officers, which combined with overcrowding makes for a really horrible cocktail.
I don't know if enough has been done about this, enough has been being reported about it. It'd be nice to see some undercover investigations from in our prisons. I think we saw one about 2 years ago, but not a lot since. The news media is changing. Press Association has won a Google grant to run news services written by computers. News agency gets €706,000 to use artificial intelligence to create up to 30,000 local stories a month. Martin, this is an interesting development, having computers writing our news for us.
Well, could computers run this show, Tony? That's the question.
Ben and Jerome, what do you make of this?
I think it's the way that things are going, but a good human journalist will outdo a computer any time.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks very much to our guests there.
Thank you.
Green Party councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas, and former Bradley Stoke councillor is now UKIP leadership candidate, Ben Walker. See you after the news.
Your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.